I.B. Park went to the governor's mansion, and Harry Truman did not. Harry Truman had wanted more than anything to be the nominee for governor, and well before T.J. ever picked Francis Wilson. Encouraged by friends and complimentary comments in several papers suggesting he would make a good chief executive for the state, he had been hugely disappointed when Pendergast refused him the nod. Then came the stunning news of Wilson's death the afternoon of October 12th, the same afternoon it happened that Harry and 35,000 others were celebrating the completion of the road program at reputedly the biggest country barbecue ever put on in Jackson County. "It was my big day," he remembered bitterly. Apparently, he lost no time in getting to Tom Pendergast, only to be told once again he was not the choice, that Guy Park had been decided on. That night, Harry drove to the little resort town of Excelsior Springs, north of the river, and checked into a hotel to remain in seclusion for several days. His anguish over his future was deep-seated and painful. Having served two consecutive terms in the court, he was ineligible to run again for county judge. And unlike so many others in public life, he had no law practice or insurance business to fall back on, nor any private income. He questioned seriously whether he had made the right choice in life. In a letter of advice to a nephew, he wrote, "It will be much better for you to go to work for a bank or some mercantile institution and get real experience than to get a political job where you learn nothing and lose out when the administration changes." With the end of his term in 1934, Harry Truman would be 50 years old. And without the blessing of Tom Pendergast, there was really not a lot more he could do in politics, whatever his aspirations. As he himself said, "Everything would be all right only as long as the big boss believes in me." The previous June, he had traveled to Chicago with T.J., as part of the Missouri delegation to the Democratic National Convention that nominated Franklin Roosevelt. Pendergast had announced himself for former United States Senator James Reed of Missouri, who had begun his career as mayor of Kansas City in the era of Alderman Jim. The brilliant, egotistical Reed had been one of the 9 willful men in the Senate who killed the League of Nations, and Harry consequently had no use for him. Pendergast's enthusiasm was mostly a pose to please Reed. In reality, he was playing a somewhat complicated game of a kind new to Harry. Pendergast, Harry was later to say, understood political situations and how to handle them better than any man I have ever known. T.J. had already made a special trip to confer with Roosevelt at Albany before the convention. James A. Farley, Roosevelt's highly influential political advisor, had also been warmly received by the Kansas City organization at a lunch at the Muleback. If anything, T.J. was more enthusiastic about Roosevelt this time than in 1924. Still, he put on a show for Reed under the lights at Chicago Stadium, and Harry, swallowing his distaste for Reed, went through the motions, the dutiful soldier, until the big boss began letting votes go to Roosevelt, a little at a time, exactly as Jim Farley wanted, to keep the Roosevelt tally steadily building with each ballot. At the end, Pendergast, Harry, the whole Jackson County delegation had come home extremely pleased with the outcome. By the following spring of 1933, Harry felt he was more in favor than ever before. "I had a fine talk with T.J. yesterday," he reported to Bess in high spirits, "and I am still on top. He told me to do as I pleased with the county payroll. He'd put the organization in line behind me. He also told me I could be congressman or collector. Think of that a while." The power of Tom Pendergast had become as great as or possibly greater than that of any political boss in the country. Major changes had taken place, promising larger roles for nearly everyone of ability in the organization. In 1930, the year Harry was re-elected presiding judge, T.J. had at last resolved the old nettling problem of the rabbits by simply convincing Joe Shannon that he belonged in Congress. The silver-haired, silver-tongued Shannon was put nicely out of the way in Washington, where he served 6 terms in the House, distinguishing himself as an apostle of the old-time faith of Thomas Jefferson. Only those who had been through the goat-rabbit struggles of past decades could appreciate what a singular victory this was for the big boss, and all so smoothly done. The year after, in 1931, Kansas City achieved home rule, which meant control of its own police, who until then had been under state authority. Thus, for all practical purposes, the organization now ran the police department. In 1932, the Missouri legislature failed to establish new congressional districts as required by Congress, with the result that every candidate for the House had to be elected at large instead of by districts. The possibilities in this for increased Pendergast power were almost too great to imagine, since the big Jackson County vote, the Pendergast vote, now bore directly on all congressional elections everywhere in the state. T.J. could not only name his own governor, but 13 men for Congress as well. And that fall, he had but one disappointment when Bennett Champ Clark of eastern Missouri made a vigorous campaign for the Senate and won, in open opposition to the Kansas City organization. This was the same Bennett Clark, the son of Missouri's famous Champ Clark, who at the railroad station in France had fooled Harry Truman into believing an enemy air attack was imminent. So, by the start of 1933, with Park in office as governor, Pendergast was riding higher than ever. The Capitol in Jefferson City was spoken of now as Uncle Tom's Cabin. With Franklin Roosevelt and his New Deal taking over in Washington, the prospects for the future looked boundless. In the small office at 1908 Main Street, a portrait of FDR now held the place of honor over TJ's roll-top desk. Even in the depths of the Depression's worst years, Kansas City was enjoying a building boom. A new 34-story power and light building, the tallest skyscraper in Missouri, stood over the city like a shining statement of faith. Swinging his car out of the driveway each morning, heading to town on Van Horn Road, Judge Truman would see it rising proudly against the horizon, the very picture of progress. A new Nelson Art Gallery was under construction at a cost of $3 million. As part of Kansas City's 10-year plan, work began on a magnificent municipal auditorium that would fill an entire block, include an arena seating 12,000, and an elegant music hall. A new police building was also part of the plan, along with a new waterworks system and a new public market. A few blocks from Judge Truman's skyscraper courthouse, a still larger city hall was going up. Compared to other cities, the Kansas City outlook was confident and expansive. There were jobs, and local government, the organization, was providing most of them. Under the direction of city manager Henry McElroy, thousands were put to work with picks and shovels, while heavy machinery was left standing by unused so that more men could be employed. McElroy would later claim it was the Kansas City Make Work program that inspired the New Deal's Works Progress Administration, the WPA. One seemingly endless project involved paving mile after mile of Brush Creek with a thick bed of Pendergast's ready-mixed concrete. If Judge Truman felt besieged by job applicants in these early Depression years, his was a small burden compared to what T.J. faced. The lines outside the yellow brick building on Main Street began gathering before dawn most weekdays and by mid-morning stretched two or three blocks. He saw as many people as possible on a first-come, first-served basis, no matter who they were, keeping the interviews to a few minutes at most, beginning about 9 and ending promptly at noon when he stopped for lunch. Rarely was anyone sent away feeling empty-handed. Invariably courteous, Pendergast would listen attentively, ask a few questions, then scrawl a note on a slip of paper requesting somebody somewhere in one or another city or county organization or in one of his own enterprises to consider the needs of the bearer and oblige, these final two words seeming to carry the full weight of his command. Actually, it depended on which color pencil he used. If the note was written in red, his "and oblige" meant the applicant should be given a job or be granted a favor without delay. If, however, the big boss wrote in blue, then this was only someone to keep in mind should anything turn up. If the note was written with an ordinary lead pencil, the bearer was nobody to bother with. When a reporter questioned Pendergast whether job holders were ever asked to donate to the organization at election time, he said, "Why shouldn't they be? That's how they got their jobs." Harry loved to tell the story of the day when there was a particularly large crowd waiting to see Pendergast, and his gatekeeper, Cap Matthews, went out to say that if there was anyone in line who had anything to give Tom, he should come directly in. But no one moved. The old Pendergast policy that politics was chiefly a business of making friends placed no limits because of ethnic background, religion, or race. To be a Democrat was to be a Democrat. Tolerance was good politics. And while less was done to alleviate suffering in the desperate Negro wards, the attitude of the Pendergast organization was seen by black people as progress. As one of them remembered, "The machine did small favors mainly, but small favors were better than no favors at all." Business people had few quibbles about the organization or the man who ruled it. Taxes were low. With a phone call or two, a talk with T.J. or young Jim, red tape wondrously dissolved. Projects went forward. People in business found they could get quick, reliable answers to important questions. That problems with the city could be resolved with amazing dispatch. The comment most often heard about Tom Pendergast was that he got things done. Even the editors of the Star at this point were impressed by the executive ability of City Manager McElroy, a judgment they lived to regret. "Kansas City probably had the most efficient city government in its history," said the Star in 1930. Presiding Judge Truman was frequently cited as an exemplary public official. But others, too, commanded respect, and deservedly. Harry Truman was not, as sometimes implied later, the sole exception to the rule in a wholly nefarious crowd. Jim Pendergast was able and honest, and had, as remembered his priest, Monsignor Arthur Tye, a remarkable kind of gentleness about him for being a politician. Attorney James P. Aylward, T.J.'s friend and advisor, and chairman of the Democratic County Committee, was astute, hard-working, and well-regarded within Kansas City professional circles. Even Pendergast himself had lately acquired some of the trappings of respectability, a degree of polish unimaginable in earlier times. He dressed now in conservative, well-tailored suits. He and his wife had been to Paris. T.J. would expound on his love of Paris without apology. He had developed a great fondness for French cooking, his friends knew. His new home on Ward Parkway in the Country Club District, Kansas City's loveliest residential section, was an exact copy of a house he had seen in France, a red brick mansion in the Regency style, perfect in every detail. Life had never been better. And by the close of the year, with Prohibition ended in December 1933, the Pendergasts would be back in the legal liquor business again. Best of their line was Old 1889 brand, named for the year Tom first arrived in Kansas City. It was 7.5-year-old Kentucky bourbon, 100 proof. That gambling, prostitution, bootlegging, the sale of narcotics, and racketeering were a roaring business in Kansas City was all too obvious. Nor did anyone for a moment doubt that the ruling spirit behind it all remained Tom Pendergast. It was the Pendergast heyday. Never, not even in the gaudy era following the Civil War, had the city known such wide-open times. 40 dance halls and more than 100 nightclubs were in operation, offering floor shows, dancers, comedians, and some of the best blues and jazz to be heard anywhere in America. The Benny Moten Orchestra at the Reno, and later at the Reno, Count Basie and his Kansas City Seven doing the 1 o'clock jump. Trumpeter Hot Lips Page at the Subway. Blues singer Julia Lee at the Yellow Front Saloon. Musicians from all over the country, most of them black and all hard hit by the Depression, came to Kansas City knowing there was work. "Every joint had music," one of them remembered. "Every joint." This, too, was heartland America. No less than the old-fashioned country town peace and quiet of nearby Independence. "Dance all night long," said an advertisement in the Star for the Musicians' Ball at the Labor Temple in the spring of 1932, at which Benny Moten, Andy Kirk and his Clouds of Joy, Walter Page and his Blue Devils, the Nighthawks, in all 8 orchestras, played until sunup. There were no closing hours. At the Subway, in a basement at 18th and Vine, 30 to 40 musicians would crowd in to play. Everybody played that wanted to play, and every night you could find music there. It never really did open until after 1 in the morning. "A cracker town, but a happy town," Count Basie remembered. The Red Light District ran for blocks on 13th and 14th Streets. One high-priced place, called the Chesterfield Club, offered a businessman's lunch served by waitresses clad only in high heels and cellophane aprons. A lifetime resident of Kansas City named John Dewan, trying years later to describe the rollicking city it had been, would suddenly stop in mid-sentence, realizing how much he missed it. "See, there just wasn't any law," said Dewan, whose job in the research library at the Star required keeping watch on the unfolding history of the city. "The club stayed open all night. Liquor flowed. There was a band in every place, and gambling even around the Star at Grand and 17th. On the northeast corner there was a bookmaker in gambling. On the southeast corner there was a bookmaker in gambling. 2 doors north of the Star there were 2 bookie joints. And then, as you went on Main, there were gambling places at 31st, at 31st and Prospect, 34th and Main. Gambling places, prostitution, wide open, knocking on windows, 2 bits, 40- and 50-cent places." Whenever questioned about this, Tom Pendergast customarily replied, "Well, the rich men have their clubs where they can gamble and have a good time. Would you deny the poor man an equal right?" "Ours is a fine, clean, and well-ordered town," Pendergast would insist repeatedly. And John Doohan, too, would remember there being little fear of violent crime. I will say the town was safe. You never got mugged. You could walk around downtown any time of the day or night. You could walk through the colored district, and there weren't any problems. I mean, things were, you know, there wasn't much crime, but there were the rackets. Others, including respected, proper citizens, conceded privately that wide open was good business, particularly in hard times. The head of the rackets, one of TJ's acknowledged chief lieutenants, was a small, dapper Italian-American with a master of ceremonies personality named Johnny Lazia, who had earlier served a prison sentence for armed robbery. Lazia was the king of Little Italy, where in 1926 he had seized power from TJ's old Ninth Ward leader, Mike Ross. TJ had accepted Lazia as part of the organization, largely because he had no choice, and apparently with the understanding that Lazia would keep Al Capone and other out-of-town gangsters clear of the city. Our Johnny, it seems, relied on his charm as well as his power, and he and boss Tom soon were fast friends. Also, importantly, TJ had by this time become a heavy gambler on horse races, and so was in continuous need of such fast friends. At the office at 1908 Main, he had installed his own direct wire to tracks in the east, even setting up betting cages at the rear of the clubroom. Across the Missouri River in Platte County, he had established his own racetrack, the Riverside Park Jockey Club, where he also kept his own stable of horses. In return for his support in the Ninth Ward, Lazia was to have control over liquor and gambling in the city, as well as a say in hiring policies at the police department. Allegedly, Lazia even had his own office at the police department. A federal agent sent to investigate Lazia's activities reported to Washington that when he called Kansas City Police Headquarters, Lazia answered the phone. Lazia, too, knew how to be a friend in need. When former Senator James Reed's companion, later wife, Nell Donnelly, was kidnapped in 1931, it was to Lazia that Reed went immediately for help, and Lazia, who brought her safely home. 2 years later, in 1933, when city manager McElroy's stylish 25-year-old daughter Mary was kidnapped, it was again our Johnny who came to the rescue, this time producing the ransom money, $30,000 in cash, which he collected with astonishing speed from friends among the gamblers. Through all this, only one brave voice was raised in protest, Samuel S. Meyerberg, the rabbi of Temple B'nai Jehuda, who in the spring of 1932 decided to speak out before a government study club, a meeting of perhaps 40 people, most of whom were women. It was then that a reform movement began, though few, and clearly no one in the organization, seemed particularly concerned. Nor was there a rush of good citizens to join his ranks. "One of my hardest jobs was not fighting the underworld," Meyerberg later said, "but in using my energy and time to convince thoroughly nice people, honorable men, that, as respectable citizens, they ought to be in the fight also." When federal investigators started proceedings against Lazia for income tax evasion in 1933, TJ wrote at once to Jim Farley, the new Postmaster General in Washington and part of FDR's inner circle, to stress how extremely important Lazia was to him. "Now, Jim," he wrote, "Lazia is one of my chief lieutenants, and I am more sincerely interested in his welfare than anything you might be able to do for me now or in the future." But then, only weeks later, came the stunning news of Kansas City's Union Station Massacre, one of the most sensational atrocities of the whole gangster era. On Saturday, June 17, 1933, three notorious bank robbers and killers, Vern Miller, Adam Ricchetti, and Pretty Boy Floyd, armed with submachine guns, attempted to rescue another public enemy, Frank Jelly Nash, as Nash, in handcuffs, was being escorted by law officers from a train to a waiting car at Union Station to make the short drive to the federal prison at Leavenworth. The three killers, who were waiting in the parking lot outside the station, made their move as Nash was being put in the car. One officer turned and fired with a pistol. The three then opened up with machine guns, killing five men, two Kansas City policemen, an agent of the FBI, a police chief from Oklahoma, and Nash, after which the killers vanished. And though none of the three had any known ties to Kansas City, a local racketeer named Michael James Jimmy Needles LaCapra would later testify that it was Johnny Lazia who arranged to get them safely out of town. True or not, Lazia became the most talked-about man in Kansas City, drawing more popular attention even than Tom Pendergast. In what was to be a long, often trying, and continuously eventful public life, some days for Harry Truman would stand out always as moments of great personal satisfaction. One was Tuesday, September 5, 1933. In the middle of what otherwise was a particularly difficult and uncertain time for him. On Tuesday, September 5th, the completed new $200,000 county courthouse at Independence, the fifth so-called remodeling of the building since 1836, was dedicated with ceremonies and festivities that began early in the morning and stretched on into the night. There were horseshoe pitching contests, an old fiddler's contest, a Negro dancing contest, music from seven marching bands and seven drum corps, a bathing beauty contest, a horse show, a street dance, a parade of floats by local merchants, and a historic pageant. The formal dedication itself took place in the afternoon, beginning at 2 by the old four-faced courthouse clock, it too newly refurbished and set now in a colonial cupola, and included speeches by Governor Park and Judge Harry S. Truman. The day was warm and sunny, the large crowd in good spirits, everybody enjoying the occasion. The homely Victorian scruffiness of the old courthouse had been transformed into something larger, more spacious, and in a style vaguely like that of Philadelphia's Independence Hall, though the architect, Harry's brother-in-law, Fred Wallace, was quoted in the day's special edition of the Examiner, saying that his inspiration for the north and south porticos had been the Greek Temple of the Winds. The new building had little of the character of what had stood there before, but was neat and trim, it seemed, with its pink brick and columned porticos, its cupola and refurbished clock and marble lobby. A clear improvement to nearly everyone, and to those especially who would work there, numbers of whom were looking down from the open windows upstairs, as Judge Truman, in a white suit, delivered his brief, unexceptional remarks from the speaker's platform. The Examiner called the building dignified, spacious, symmetrical, and praised the leadership of the man who more than any other had made it possible. During the 6 1/2 years of his administration as presiding judge, Harry S. Truman, with the hearty cooperation of his associates on the county bench, has done a number of remarkably big things that will occupy a large place in the history of the county, said the paper, which then went on to list a few. A $10 million road and bridge system built by two bond issues, a modern hospital at the Jackson County Home for the Aged and Infirm, a girls' home for Negroes on the county farm, a new Kansas City courthouse estimated to cost $4 million, and now the $200,000 Independence Courthouse. It was a record unmatched in the history of the county. During these years of strenuous service to Jackson County, the Examiner also wrote of Judge Truman, he has found time to serve as president of the National Old Trails Association, an office he still holds. He has become widely known throughout Missouri, and many of his friends have expressed the opinion that he will fill the office of governor someday. But to Judge Truman himself, his future remained a large mystery and a worry. Later in the fall of 1933, outraged that the Roosevelt administration had appointed a Republican as director of the Federal Reemployment Service in Missouri, Tom Pendergast complained to Washington, with the immediate result that the Republican was fired and the job given to Judge Truman. Having no wish to relinquish his place on the county court any sooner than necessary, Harry agreed to serve in this new federal post without pay. He waived the $300 a month salary and began driving to and from the federal office in Jefferson City halfway across the state twice a week. The task was to channel unemployed laborers into jobs with contractors on federal public works, and with his experience in county projects, he was ideally suited. The long drives also provided time to think about the future. For Pendergast, it was another giant step. In a few months, the Missouri Democrat, a paper controlled by the organization, could report that 100,000 men and nearly 10,000 women were employed in the state under the new federal Democratic program. Harry found himself reporting to Harry Hopkins, Roosevelt's public works official, and traveling to Washington on government business, something he had never done before. At long last, Harry made up his mind. He would run for Congress, he decided, against the wishes of his wife, who had liked the sound of the collector's job with its high pay and security, and who greatly preferred staying in Independence. In Congress, Harry told her, he would have the chance for some power in the nation. But when he went to see T.J., he was told the choice was no longer his. Pendergast had picked another man, a circuit court judge named Jasper Bell, who would win handily in the primary and again in November and go on to serve six terms in Congress. Crestfallen, Harry found himself out in the cold again. Maneuvered out, as he said. Weeks went by. Nothing more was mentioned, no further offer made. His spirits fell to a new low. Then, in early May 1934, everything changed. Stopping at Warsaw, Missouri, on a speaking tour, he received a call from Jim Pendergast asking him to meet as soon as possible at the Bothwell Hotel in Sedalia. It was a matter of importance. The drive to Sedalia took about half an hour. Pendergast had Jim Aylward with him, and the three of them drew up chairs in a corner of the hotel lobby. Harry had no idea what was coming. There had been a meeting, he was told. T.J. wanted him to run for the United States Senate. Harry was incredulous, almost speechless. "The boss is 95% for you," Aylward assured him. "What's wrong with the other 5%?" Truman asked. "Oh, you know what I mean," Aylward said. "The boss is for you." He needed time to think, Truman said. They told him he had to do it for the good of the party, and this apparently settled the issue. He agreed to run, but said he was broke. In another day or so, Aylward and Jim Pendergast each gave him $500 to get started. As Harry learned soon enough, he was anything but T.J.'s first choice for the Senate. T.J. had asked at least three others to run, only to be turned down by all three. Jim Reed had been asked first, largely as a courtesy. The New York Times had predicted Reed would be the choice. When Reed said no, T.J. turned to Joe Shannon, who professed feeling too out of sympathy with the New Deal and said that at his age he preferred to remain in the House. The third and most serious choice was Aylward, who, everyone agreed, would have made a strong candidate and a first-rate senator if elected. His name had been mentioned repeatedly in the papers as a prime possibility. But Aylward had no longing for the life in Washington, he told T.J., no wish to give up time with his family or leave his law practice. Other names came up. When Jim Pendergast suggested Harry Truman, whose name to this moment had never been on anyone's list, Aylward enthusiastically agreed. T.J. was skeptical.
"Do you mean to tell me that you actually believe that Truman can be elected to the United States Senate?"
Aylward would remember Pendergast exclaiming. But Aylward and Jim persisted until T.J. agreed. Joe Shannon, when consulted, said he thought T.J.'s initial reaction had been the right one. Truman was too light, Shannon thought. "A very pleasant sort of fellow," Shannon would later explain to a reporter, "and he's clean. On the other hand, I don't think he's heavy enough for the Senate. I can't imagine him there." "But," added Shannon, "Tom hasn't got a field of world beaters to pick from."
The Truman candidacy was announced on May 14, 1934. Before dawn that morning, alone in a room at the Pickwick Hotel, he had written, "Today, it is 4 a.m., I have to make the most momentous announcement of my life. I have come to the place where all men strive to be at my age, and I thought 2 weeks ago that retirement on a virtual pension in some minor county office was all that was in store for me."
Section 2. The state of Missouri comprises nearly 70,000 square miles, an area larger than all New England. The population in 1934 was 3.7 million, with more than 1 million people, roughly a third, concentrated in the two largest cities, St. Louis and Kansas City, some 260 miles apart at opposite ends of the state. The landscape varied enormously, from the low alluvial cotton lands of the southeastern Boot Heel along the Mississippi to the rugged Ozark Hills in the south-central section, to the prairie farmlands along the Kansas border. A dozen railroads crisscrossed the state, and a half-dozen airlines flew in and out of St. Louis and Kansas City, while charter plane service was available for such smaller cities as St. Joseph, Springfield, and Joplin. But it was by automobile that Missouri Democrats waged their primary battles for Congress that summer of 1934, with candidates and campaign workers, hundreds of soldiers in the ranks, fanning out over the state, traveling many thousands of miles. And though the two major highways between Kansas City and St. Louis, Route 40 through Columbia and Route 50 by way of Jefferson City, were the fastest main-traveled roads, there was hardly a road anywhere, hardtop or dirt, that went untraveled, as each faction tried to win the courthouse towns in a state where there were a total of 114 county seats. And it was a task made no easier by the fact that the summer of 1934 in Missouri was the hottest on record. The heat came up from the highways in shimmering waves like a mirage on the desert. "It was 104 yesterday and 102 today," Kathleen Pendergast, the wife of Jim Pendergast, read in a letter from her husband, who had been on the road, busy running hither and thither, as he said, ever since Harry Truman made his announcement.
Jim Pendergast and Jim Aylward had driven first to Jefferson City to be sure Guy B. Park was in line, and to call on those state employees, a very great number indeed, who, like Governor Park, owed their jobs to the Kansas City organization. At the same time, some 50 others from Kansas City were traveling the state, dispatched to whichever county or small town they had originally come from, to drum up support for Judge Truman. Jim's assignment for the moment was to call on local newspapers. Distressed by the weather, he longed for a storm to clear the air. But in all, the temperature would register 100 degrees or above for 21 days in July. Only Harry Truman appeared untroubled by the heat, a peculiarity that would be noticed often in times ahead. It was Aylward, now chairman of the state committee, who ran the campaign. And the opening Truman rally at Columbia was a model operation, as Kansas City took over Columbia. An estimated 4,000 people filled the lawn in front of the Boone County Courthouse, close by the University of Missouri campus. Besides the busloads of people from Kansas City, a big Jefferson City turnout had been orchestrated. State employees from every department, reportedly, and a newfangled loud-speaking truck stood by to carry Judge Truman's speech. A sure sign, said the papers, of politics brought up to date. With the noise and color of the gathering crowds and an American Legion band pumping away, the mood seemed more like that of a homecoming game. Harry had two opponents in the race, Jacob L. Tuck Milligan from Richmond, and John J. Jack Cochran from St. Louis, both of whom were Missouri congressmen experienced in the ways of Washington and far better known than Harry. Cochran, a big, friendly, humorous, and honest man, was favored to win. He was a congressman's congressman, someone known to understand the wheels-within-wheels intricacy of government, and who, importantly, also had the support of the St. Louis counterpart of the Pendergast machine, the so-called Igo Dickman organization. Tuck Milligan, in his favor, was backed by Senator Bennett Clark. Milligan was seen as Clark's way of again challenging Tom Pendergast and gaining a second seat for himself in the Senate. And like his father before him, Clark was a colorful, two-fisted stump speaker. Opening their campaigns weeks earlier, Milligan and Cochran had both focused on Harry Truman's one clear advantage in the race, the Pendergast power behind him, as his greatest liability, portraying him as a mere machine stooge. Their attacks, furthermore, came just as the excesses of the organization had again become lurid news, as violence in Kansas City's municipal elections left dozens of people injured and four dead. So Harry was an easy mark. Now, at Columbia, in a speech carried statewide by radio, he lashed back. "It will be remembered that Mr. Milligan and Mr. Cochran journeyed to Kansas City 2 years ago and sought and received the endorsement of the Kansas City organization for their races for the nomination as congressman at large for Missouri." As for Bennett Clark, he only wanted more power to make himself boss. In days following, in Saline County and at Boonville, Harry tried to change the tone and subject. The Depression was the issue, he insisted, declaring his all-out faith in the New Deal. "A New Deal for Missouri," said a placard in the window of the newfangled loud-speaking truck. He talked of the capitalist domination of government in bygone Republican times, praised the determination of FDR to end the rule of the rich and give the average American a chance. 90% of the wealth of the country was in the hands of 4% of the population, he said at Springfield. Roosevelt was the man of the hour to chase the money changers from the temple, so that the common people of the country could have a chance at the good things of life.
The party of Jefferson, Jackson, and Franklin D. Roosevelt was the party for the everyday man just like you and me. He called for shorter working hours, higher pay, old age pensions, payment of the soldier's bonus. He also called his opponents in the primary his friends, and said any remarks he might make about them would be of a purely political nature. But the Pendergast issue would not go away. And since Milligan and Cochrane were both stressing their own all-out support for Roosevelt, Pendergast was in practicality the only issue. Then, on Tuesday, July 10th, with Harry's campaign not yet a week old, the quiet of night in Kansas City exploded with machine gun fire. It happened at 3 a.m. The victim this time was Johnny Lazia, cut down as he was about to open a car door for his wife in front of the Park Central Hotel. Two unknown assailants had been waiting in the dark. Lazia was hit 8 times.
"Why to me, to Johnny Lazia, who has been a friend to everybody?" he moaned to a doctor at the hospital.
According to the account spread across the front page of the early morning edition of the Kansas City Journal-Post, he then delivered what were very nearly his last words.
"If anything happens, notify Mr. Pendergast, my best friend, and tell him I love him."
Tom Pendergast and City Manager McElroy were prominent among the mourners at Holy Rosary Catholic Church for Lazia's funeral, the biggest ever seen in Kansas City, despite a temperature of 106 degrees.
"There were at least 10,000 people down around the church who couldn't get in," Jim Pendergast recorded. "Of course, a lot of them were simply curiosity seekers, but Johnny did have a world of friends."
The next night, across the state near St. Louis at Washington, Missouri, Senator Bennett Clark, in support of Tuck Milligan, pulled off his tie, loosened his collar, and tore into Harry Truman as no one ever had until then. It was Missouri politics with the bark off, the style Missouri loved.
"It seems my old friend Judge Harry S. Truman finds it easier to abuse me than to set forth his own qualifications," the senator began slowly. His opening speech at Columbia, which was attended almost exclusively by a mob from Kansas City, in fact, I am informed the natives looked over the crowd to see if Dillinger was there, by a lot of state employees ordered out by their superiors as a condition to holding their jobs and herded over in buses like trucks carrying cattle to market, was largely an attack on me. Harry fears that someone from the eastern part of Missouri may undertake to set up as boss. Harry Truman fears a boss in Missouri. God save the mark. Harry places the intelligence of the Democrats of Missouri so low and estimates their credulity so high that he actually went into great length in promising people that if elected to the Senate he would not set up as a boss or undertake to dictate to anybody. Why, bless Harry's good, kind heart. No one has ever accused him of being a boss or wanting to be a boss, and nobody will ever suspect him of trying to dictate to anybody in his own right as long as a certain eminent citizen of Jackson County remains alive and in possession of his health and faculties. In view of the judge's record of subserviency in Jackson County, it would seem that his assurances against any assumption of bossship are a trifle gratuitous, to say the least. When all three candidates, plus Bennett Clark and Governor Guy B. Park, appeared at a huge picnic in Clay County, north of Kansas City, an annual affair sponsored by St. Munchin's Catholic Church, Harry was clearly outclassed. Bennett Clark held the crowd spellbound, though it was Milligan who got the biggest applause. 10,000 people sat resolutely through 4 hours of political oratory as the sun beat down. Deeply interested in the array of political lights that paraded across the rough board rostrum
wrote a reporter. The perspiring crowd held its ground throughout. The president of the Missouri Farmers Association, William Hirth, joined the Cochran campaign and began referring to Truman as Tom Pendergast's bellhop. For this bellhop of Pendergast to aspire to make a jump from the obscure bench of a county judge to the United States Senate is without precedent. When one contemplates the giants of the past who have represented Missouri, this spectacle is not only grotesque, it is sheer buffoonery. Striking back, Harry charged Milligan with padding the government payroll with relatives, but saved his harshest invective for Bennett Clark. The senator, said Harry, ran for office on his father's reputation, but his record proved there was nothing in heredity. Many who thought they knew Judge Truman were astonished by the different man he became now, under attack. Judge Truman is unobtrusive in his work, wrote a correspondent for the St. Louis Globe-Democrat. His decisions are made in low tones. There is no braggadocio about him. He sees his job and does it quietly. But in a fight, this quiet man can and does hurl devastating fire. Truman, said Bennett Clark, was conducting a campaign of mendacity and imbecility unmatched in Missouri history. What Harry is really trying to do is to secure a good county job for himself on his retirement from the county court of Jackson County next January. Harry himself told me of his hopes. Perhaps the heat was affecting Harry Truman, Clark surmised, because ordinarily he was neither vicious nor inventive enough to tell such lies. Further, Clark charged that 7,000 or 8,000 state employees were out campaigning for Truman, all at taxpayers' expense. But then, such, alas, was the Pendergast way. T.J., demonstrating that he still knew a few things about bringing politicians down to size, invited a reporter into his office and, in the course of an affable, soft-spoken conversation, remarked, "Why, Senator Clark is a friend of mine. He was in here just the other day." Jack Cochran, to his credit, tried to keep the debate on a serious level. Mudslinging, Cochran said, was a luxury for prosperous times and had no place when conditions were so desperate and so many were suffering. In a speech in front of the Capitol at Jefferson City, Harry Truman, too, talked of his sadness over so much that he had seen traveling the countryside. Farm prices, in steady decline since the Coolidge years, had gone from bad to worse. Eggs that normally sold for 25 cents a dozen were bringing 5 cents. Since 1930, more than 18,000 Missouri farms had been foreclosed. Abandoned houses, their windows boarded, fences falling, dotted the landscape. Sharecroppers were living in two-room, dirt-floor shacks, walls insulated with old newspapers. The look of the land and in the faces of farm families in this summer of 1934 was as bleak as in anyone's memory. Certainly Harry Truman had never seen anything comparable. It was both the worst of the Depression and the year dust storms on the western plains began making headlines. With no rain and the fierce heat continuing, crops were burning up all over Missouri. An editorial in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch assumed a biblical cadence in its description of the tragedy. Under merciless summer suns, the fields ached, and the corn withered, and the cattle perished, and the rivers became as scars of dust as the drought droned its hymn of hate. Conditions, said Truman in one speech, were such as to make any human with a heart anxious to alleviate them. He presented himself as a common-sense country boy. He was the good Baptist farmer from Grandview, repeatedly poking fun at his rivals as city farmers. And he looked the part,
deeply tanned from days in the sun, lean, fit, hard as nails by one account. He was 50 now, and there was considerably more gray in his hair, yet he seemed much younger. He smiled constantly, a big politician's grin, his even white teeth looking whiter than usual because of the tan, his eyes flashing behind the steel-rimmed glasses. Joe Shannon, among others, thought he smiled entirely too much. One blistering day, on a road near Mexico, Missouri, seeing a farmer in a field having trouble with his binder, Harry stopped the car, climbed the fence, introduced himself, took off his coat, and proceeded to set up the binder under a hot sun for his newfound friend, as reported in the local paper in a story that did him no harm with the local farmers. Truman and Cochran were both battling for the farm vote, knowing it could decide the election. Neither of them had a chance without the support of their respective big city machines, but if the votes for Cochran in St. Louis and those for Truman in Kansas City proved equal, then it would be the farmers who named the winner. Jim Pendergast worried that the farmers were more concerned about the prospects for rain than about politics. In 6 weeks, candidate Truman covered the greater part of Missouri by automobile, by main highways and winding back roads, until he had appeared before, shaken hands, and visited with courthouse crowds in more than half of the 114 county seats. It was hot, exhausting, throat-parching, day and night work, and he greatly enjoyed nearly every moment. He had always liked being on the road. "Fact is, I like roads," he would say. "I like to move." He felt as good as if he were on vacation, he told reporters, and he looked it. Again, as on the earlier cross-country courthouse survey, he was accompanied by Fred Canfill, whose hulking, blustery presence left some people wondering. If a man could be judged by the company he kept, why on earth would Judge Truman choose such a companion? But Canfill was as hard-working, as willing to put in 10 to 15 hours a day as ever. Besides, Harry found him amusing good company, if eccentric and at times exasperating. Arriving at a hotel, Canfill would immediately check Harry's quarters to see that all was satisfactory, bathroom, sink, toilet, bathtub, and oblivious to the fact that he was scattering his cigarette ashes everywhere he went. Canfill and Truman were to be together for years, as things turned out, Truman refusing to abandon Canfill or to make apologies for him. Some days that summer they covered several hundred miles, stopping for food and gas and speeches at a dozen or more places. Some towns were good-sized, like Hannibal on the Mississippi, Mark Twain's town, which had grown to 20,000 people, or Poplar Bluff, seat of Butler County, on the bright, clear, misnamed Black River, in the southeastern corner of the state. Poplar Bluff had a population of 10,000. More often, the candidates spoke in places like Ladadonia, Elmo, Liberty, or Benton, towns of 600 people or less. At Benton, seat of Scott County, population 400 and known for its chicken-calling contest on Neighbor Day each October, bobcats were still a sufficient menace in the 1930s to require an organized drive on them. At Liberty, just north of the Missouri River from Independence in Clay County, the little two-story bank building on the northeast corner of the courthouse square looked no different from the day in 1866 when it was held up by Jesse James. The crowds that turned out to hear Judge Truman were seldom large, no more usually than a cluster of a few hundred people standing quietly, attentively, in the shade of a courthouse lawn, while in his rapid-fire fashion he spoke from the courthouse steps. A good part of his usual audience was composed of courthouse loafers, old-timers with nothing better to do,
and invariably small boys free from school for the summer. The atmosphere was old-fashioned and neighborly, and though the response to him was rarely demonstrative, he seemed always to leave his crowds feeling better. For a scrapbook of the campaign, Fred Canfill kept clipping the local papers along the way. One item dated August 3rd, from an unidentified paper, acknowledged that Judge Truman was no orator, but then this was an argument in his favor, since there was already too much oratory in the United States Senate. At a banquet in his honor at the Baltimore Hotel in Kansas City the week before the primary, Tuck Milligan brought 700 people to their feet cheering when, without mentioning Tom Pendergast by name, he said that anyone who perpetrated vote fraud in America ought to be treated as a common criminal. As for his opponent Harry Truman, who was still campaigning at the other end of the state, Milligan joked, "Why, if Harry ever goes to the Senate, he will grow calluses on his ears, listening on the long-distance telephone to the orders of his boss." Milligan by now was clearly falling behind, while Cochran and Truman appeared to be neck and neck. On the day of the primary, August 7th, once the smoke blew away, as Harry said, he had won by 40,000 votes. The final tally was Truman, 276,850, Cochran, 236,105. Milligan, who ran a poor third, received 147,614. Harry had done well with the farmers, but so had Cochran, carrying as many counties as Truman. The big margin of victory, after all, was in Jackson County, where a grand total of 137,000 votes had been rolled up for Truman, nearly half of all he received. 2 years before, with Pendergast's support in his race for Congress, Cochran had carried Jackson County by an overwhelming 95,000 votes. This time, with the organization against them, Cochran and Milligan together received all of 11,000 votes. In some Kansas City precincts, Cochran failed to get a single vote. Cochran felt his big mistake in the race had been to predict he would get 125,000 votes in St. Louis. This, he thought, had only made the Pendergast people work harder. As it was, Cochran's margin in St. Louis and St. Louis County was 112,000, 25,000 votes less than what had been achieved by the machine at the other end of the state. The Kansas City Star called it a Pendergast triumph, pure and simple. The one consolation was that western Missouri would now have representation in the Senate. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch expressed the view that the winning of the Democratic nomination for United States Senator by Judge Harry S. Truman of Independence was without significance. No one seemed to think that Truman himself had had a thing to do with his victory, and he himself was quoted saying only how much he appreciated all that his friends had done for him. As expected, the general election in the fall was a pushover. Harry's Republican opponent was the incumbent who proudly carried the name of an infamous New York Republican of the Grant era, Roscoe Conkling. He was Roscoe Conkling Patterson. Harry's expenses in the primary had come to $12,286. In the general election, they were $785. Afterward, he and Jim Aylward made a flying visit to Washington to call on Bennett Clark, who had been the biggest loser in the primary fight, and who now, looking to his own re-election a few years hence, preferred to forget all he had ever said against his good friend Harry Truman and the Kansas City organization. In a talk before the Kansas City Elks Club, Harry said he hoped to keep his feet on the ground in Washington. By December, the final touches were being added to the handsome new 21-story courthouse in Kansas City. On the day of its dedication, after Christmas, as her father beamed with pleasure, 10-year-old Margaret Truman helped pull the string to unveil Charles Keck's equestrian bronze of Andrew Jackson. Margaret had grown tall for her age, skinny and all one color, faded blonde, a friend would remember, and clearly she enjoyed being her father's daughter. As a reward for faithful service, Fred Canfill was made building director of Jackson County, a kind of glorified custodian or janitor for the new courthouse, and would, according to later testimony, prove very energetic and very noisy and loud-mouthed, and run things better than any other previous custodian. They were exciting days for the Trumans. The week after, on January 3, 1935, Bess and Margaret, with Jim Pendergast, watched from the visitors' gallery in the United States Senate as Harry, barely recognizable in morning coat and striped pants, walked with Senator Clark down the blue-carpeted aisle to the dais to take the oath of office from Vice President John Nance Garner. On the day Harry bid goodbye to Tom Pendergast in Kansas City, Pendergast had told him, "Work hard, keep your mouth shut, and answer your mail." Section 3. Harry Truman had an unusually retentive mind. He remembered people, names, personal interests, family connections. He remembered things he had read or learned in school long before, often bringing them into conversation in a way that amazed others. He remembered every kindness he had ever been shown, the help given in hard times, and particularly would he remember those who treated him well when he first arrived in Washington at age 50, knowing almost no one and entirely without experience as a legislator. He would fondly recall Harry Hopkins, for example, because Hopkins had shown him kindness in this most difficult of times in his life. Another was William Helm, Washington correspondent for the Kansas City Journal-Post, to whom the new senator had gone for help at the start, confessing he was green as grass and in need of someone to show him around. At first, Helm took this as a joke. Here, he thought, was the eighth natural wonder of the world, a politician who didn't take himself too seriously, a friendly, likable, warm-hearted fellow, with a lot of common sense hidden under an overpowering inferiority complex. Two other new Democratic senators, Carl Hatch of New Mexico and Louis Schwellenbach of Washington, went out of their way to be friendly. Hatch was self-effacing and bookish, Schwellenbach a real guy and a wheel horse. Among the older veteran senators, Harry could count a half dozen from both sides of the aisle who gave encouragement, and like Hatch and Schwellenbach, they were all from the West, or were at least Western in outlook. Extremely important to Harry, as events proved, was Burton K. Wheeler, a lanky, independent-minded Montana Democrat, something of a rogue who smoked big cigars and ran the powerful Interstate Commerce Committee. Carl Hayden of Arizona, another Democrat, had come to Congress in 1911 as a territorial representative. He took the trouble to explain some of the technicalities and customs of the Senate, which appear pretty confusing to a newcomer, Harry would write. Republicans Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan and old William E. Borah, the Lion of Idaho, never treated him as anything but an equal. And most memorable was 72-year-old J. Hamilton Ham Lewis of Illinois, the majority whip, who wore pince-nez, wing collars, spats, and a wavy pink toupee to match his pink Van Dyke whiskers and sweeping mustache,
and who one day came and sat down in an empty seat beside Senator Truman.
"Harry, don't start out with an inferiority complex," Lewis said kindly. "For the first 6 months you'll wonder how the hell you got here. And after that, you'll wonder how the hell the rest of us got here."
He was liked also by the red-faced, hard-drinking vice president, Cactus Jack Garner of Texas, who still dressed in a swallow-tailed coat and striped pants, and who, echoing T.J.'s parting words, told Truman to study hard and keep quiet until he knew what he was talking about. It was advice Garner always gave beginners, but that not all heeded. He, too, was a man of little formal education and obscure background. Now and then, as time passed, he would ask Truman to take the vice president's chair and preside over the Senate. On a day when Will Rogers came to Capitol Hill for lunch, Garner invited Harry to come along, a favor and an occasion Harry would never forget. Such gestures were the exception, however.
"I was under a cloud," he would say later. The Kansas City reputation had followed him to Washington.
Bennett Clark was spoken of as the senator from Missouri. Harry Truman was the senator from Pendergast. Bronson Cutting of New Mexico had a way of looking through Truman as though he didn't exist. Pat McCarran of Nevada later recalled, "I never considered him a senator." George W. Norris of Nebraska, the great voice of reform in the Senate, thought he was poison and refused to speak to him. When a congressional aide named Victor Messall, a native Missourian and an experienced hand on the Hill, was offered a job on Senator Truman's staff, he refused, fearing what the association might do to his career. "Here was a guy sent up to Washington by gangsters," he remembered. "I'd lose my reputation if I worked for him." Messall only changed his mind after volunteering to help the senator hunt for an apartment, which they found on Connecticut Avenue. 4 rooms in the Tilden Gardens apartments for $150 a month. Later, they stopped at a piano store, where Truman sat down and played several before choosing one to rent for $5 a month. From there, they went to a bank. While Messall waited, the senator took out a loan for furniture. This, Messall decided, was an altogether different kind of man from what he imagined, and one he now wanted very much to work for. A slim, snappy dresser, his hair slicked back Fred Astaire style, Messall became number one of a staff of 5 in Truman's office. The reporter William Helm would describe him watching over the senator thereafter with dog-like devotion. Making his first call at the White House in February, a nervous Senator Truman found Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes, Secretary of Agriculture Henry Wallace, and 1 or 2 others high up in the administration sitting about the waiting room, busily talking and paying no notice of him. Though scheduled for 15 minutes with the president, his time was cut to 7, during which he remained tongue-tied before Roosevelt. "It was quite an event for a country boy to go calling on the President of the United States," he remembered. His telephone calls to the White House in the months to follow often went unanswered. "He came to the Senate, I believe, with a definite inferiority complex," wrote his boyhood friend Charlie Ross, who had become a Washington correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. "He was a better man than he knew." His diligence was noteworthy. Most mornings he turned up at his office so early, about 7, and so in advance of everyone else in the building that it was decided he should have his own passkey, reportedly the first ever issued to a senator. Indeed, he would rise and be on his way so early in the morning that by mid-afternoon he would look in need of another shave. He carried himself straighter than a tall man would, walked considerably faster than customary in Washington. On good days, he walked the several miles to the Capitol. moving along at a steady military clip of 120 paces a minute and stopping usually at Child's Restaurant for breakfast. When he didn't walk, he took the trolley that ran down Connecticut Avenue, then swung east on Pennsylvania past the White House and on up to the Capitol. "By the time his colleagues get down to work," wrote William Helm, "Senator Truman has been through the morning mail, dictated several hundred letters, fixed up as many deserving Democrats with jobs as possible, and is raring to go." That his ties to Tom Pendergast continued, he left no doubt. To one Kansas City job applicant who asked his support, he wrote, "If you will send us the endorsements from the Kansas City Democratic Organization, I shall be glad to do what I can for you." This, in his view, was how the game had always been played, not by Tom Pendergast only, but in American politics overall from the beginning. And he was never to view it differently. To the victors went the spoils. He saw to the appointment of hundreds of people to hundreds of different jobs in Missouri, including old friends and family. His brother Vivian would go to work for the Federal Housing Agency in Kansas City. Ted Marks was set up in a job with the Labor Department in the Veterans Employment Service in Kansas City. Edgar Hind became postmaster in Independence, a job he held for 25 years. In the reception area of his office, over the marble mantelpiece where no one could possibly miss it, Senator Truman put a framed portrait of T.J. Pendergast. His office was number 248, on the second floor of the immense Senate Office Building, later named the Russell Building, northeast of the Capitol, his windows looking onto an interior courtyard. In the Senate chamber, he was assigned seat 94, one of seven newly installed behind the back row on the Democratic side to accommodate the disproportionate Democratic majority. To his right sat Sherman Minton of Indiana. The seat on the left remained empty until June, when the newly elected senator from West Virginia, Rush Holt, would turn 30 and thus be old enough, according to the Constitution, to take his place. Of the 96 senators in this, the 74th Congress, there were, including Senator Holt, 69 Democrats and 27 Republicans. Bennett Clark sat almost directly ahead, two rows down. Beyond Clark, about midway in the second row, was Tom Connolly of Texas, who still wore the black bow tie and old-fashioned stand-up collar of the classic Southern statesman. Alban Barkley of Kentucky and Hugo Black of Alabama, two senators of great importance to the administration, were also in the second row, and Ellison Durant Cottonhead Smith of South Carolina, who was known for his orations on King Cotton and Southern womanhood, and his near-perfect aim with tobacco juice. In the majority leader's front row seat on the aisle sat Joseph T. Robinson of Arkansas. While over near the other end of the first row, to Harry's left in seat 17, was the storm center of the chamber, the place of Huey Long of Louisiana, whose rampant outbursts against the administration lately included the charge that Franklin Roosevelt was personally trying to destroy him. The year before, Long had proclaimed his National Share Our Wealth program, promising to make every man a king, every girl a queen. And through Harry Truman's first months in the Senate, Long dominated, upstaging everyone. In early February, he opened an assault on Jim Farley, charging that Farley's operations were steeped in corruption. Then, on February 20th, calling Farley a political monster, Long inserted in the congressional record an article from the Post-Dispatch describing how T.J. Pendergast had arranged with Farley to call off Internal Revenue investigations of Johnny Lazia. Long afterward told Harry it was only a little politics to please the home folks. On the day of another long tirade, when Harry was presiding in the vice president's chair, most of the Senate got up and walked out. Later, when he and Long found themselves crossing the street together, heading for the Senate office building, Long asked how Harry had liked the speech. He had stayed, Harry said, only because he was in the chair and had no choice. Thereafter, Long refused to speak to him. In September, in Louisiana, Long would be shot and killed by an assassin. But if repelled by someone like Huey Long, Harry cared little more for other celebrated speechifiers in the Senate. Admittedly fearful of making a speech himself, he seemed to resent particularly those who could and who made their reputations that way. They were the egotistical boys whose specialty was talk. Watching Senator Truman from the press gallery, William Helm wrote, "He sits in the back row of the top-heavy Democratic side of the Senate at every session, listening, absorbing, learning. His is the conventional way. He ruffles no oldster's feathers, treads on no toes." 4 months passed before he dared introduce his first bill. It concerned a subject he knew about from experience, a bill to provide insurance by the Farm Credit Administration of mortgages on farm property, and was sent by Vice President Garner to the Committee on Banking and Currency, where it promptly died. As customary for freshman senators, he was assigned to two major and several lesser committees. In former days, the Committee on Appropriations would have been a position of dignity, little work, and little significance. But in the New Deal Washington of 1935, it was the largest committee of all, its power unprecedented. The appropriation that January of $4.8 billion for work relief represented approximately half what the government spent. Interstate Commerce, the committee of which Burton K. Wheeler was chairman, seemed a natural place for Harry, with his background in roads and highways, his lifelong fascination with railroads. The smaller assignments included the Public Buildings and Grounds Committee and the Printing Committee, headed by Carl Hayden and responsible primarily for the Congressional Record. Mama Truman had asked Harry to put her on the list for the Record and became a steadfast reader. The one assignment he did not care for was the District of Columbia Committee, which eventually he quit. He thought the district ought to have self-government. He worked exceedingly hard at his assignments. Indeed, his first years in the Senate were devoted almost exclusively to committee work. Seldom did he miss a meeting of the two major committees, where it was also noted, "He speaks rarely, listens much." He was getting acquainted with the way things were done, which most veteran senators and staff people knew to be an art in itself. He was acutely aware of his limited formal education, and in a determined effort to compensate for it, he never let up. Assigned by Senator Wheeler to a new Interstate Commerce Subcommittee investigating railroad finances, he searched the Library of Congress for books on railroad management, railroad history, until more than 50 volumes were piled in his office. "I'm going to be better informed on the transportation problem than anyone here," he vowed privately. What surprised and disappointed him was to find how few others from Congress ever used the library. He had come into national public life at the start of the second 100 days, the high tide of the New Deal. The crusade now was not just recovery from the Depression, but for reform, and he voted with the Democratic majority time after time, helping to pass some of the most far-reaching legislation in the history of Congress. He never once spoke for a measure, never took part in debate. He just voted. for the Wagner Labor Relations Act, guaranteeing the right of workers to join unions and to bargain collectively, for establishment of the Works Progress Administration, for the Social Security Act, and for rural electrification, which may have changed the way people lived more than any other single measure of the Roosevelt years. In his own state in 1935, 9 out of 10 farms had no electricity. As a member of the Interstate Commerce Committee, he worked intensively on what became the Public Utility Holding Company Act, designed as a blow against public power cartels, and in the process had his first brush with big-time lobbying and high-powered witnesses. The lobby set up headquarters in a suite at the Mayflower Hotel. He resolved to deny no one a hearing. "I'll take all the dinners he has to put out," he would later write of a lobbyist for a Midwestern railroad, "and then do what I think is right." A true son of Missouri, he wanted all the facts. "I can see no harm in talking to anyone, no matter what his background. In fact, I think everyone has a right to be heard if you expect to get all the facts." At the hearings, witnesses for the public utilities included such prominent Wall Street figures as Wendell Willkie, president of the Commonwealth and Southern, and John W. Davis, the former Democratic presidential candidate. The propaganda barrage, as Truman attested, was such as no county judge in Missouri had ever experienced. Constituents with utility stocks sent 30,000 letters and telegrams. He burned them all, Harry claimed years later, though Mildred Dryden, his secretary, would remember no such conflagration. The lobby also sent people to Kansas City to see Tom Pendergast, who apparently took their side. But that too failed, according to Harry. In June, the bill passed the Senate by a wide margin as expected, with Senator Truman paired in favor. Detained on important business, he had arranged to vote for the bill if the outcome looked close. The important business was driving Bess and Margaret back to Independence for the summer. After 5 months, they had had enough of Washington. "I was a new dealer from the start," he would say firmly and proudly later, and the record showed that few in the Senate could match his record of support for Franklin Roosevelt. Senator Robert Wagner of New York, author of so much New Deal legislation, was to praise Senator Truman as extremely useful. Yet in manner, background, language, age, choice of companions, he bore no resemblance to the ardent young New Dealers portrayed by one historian as trained in the law, economics, public administration, or new technical fields, brilliant and dedicated, nurtured on progressive ideals, schooled in the improved universities of the 1920s. Like so many things about Washington, liberals were a new experience for him. And generally speaking, he didn't care for them unless they were of the Burton Wheeler variety, Western in style and a bit rough about the edges. The rest seemed lacking in common sense for all their education. He was heart and soul an Andrew Jackson, William Jennings Bryan, T.J. Pendergast kind of Democrat. He loved politics in large part exactly because it meant time spent with men like Cactus Jack Garner, who would be remembered for observing that the vice presidency was not worth a pitcher of warm piss. Privately, he enjoyed poking fun at the boys with the Harvard accents, though never, as far as is known, at the Harvard man in the White House. He voted with the president repeatedly because he genuinely wanted to do what was best for the common people at a time when so many were in desperate need of help. He considered himself one of them. He knew what they were suffering. But he knew also, of course, the value of voting with the president, the leader, the boss, both as an article of faith and as a way ahead. Alban Barkley of Kentucky, assistant to the majority leader, would describe later how he had liked Harry Truman almost at once, instinctively. As the old political saying goes, he voted right. To many liberals in the Senate, he was go-along, get-along Harry, a decent, sincere man whose company they often enjoyed. "I liked Harry Truman," Claude Pepper of Florida remembered, but he was not someone to take seriously. The president had told Congress it could not go home without passing his entire program. So Congress labored through the sweltering summer of 1935, the worst summer of the Dust Bowl, the summer when, for the benefit of the newsreel cameras, on a day the temperature hit 110 degrees, one Texas congressman fried an egg on the Capitol steps. Harry called it a hot wave in a letter to Bess and Margaret. But he never complained about the heat or the work, only about their being so far from him. He gave up the apartment, moved to a hotel to save money, and wrote to them constantly, from his room or the office or at his desk in the Senate, and particularly if someone like Huey Long were spouting. Long had begun calling the president a faker and predicting revolution if things didn't soon change. Once he held the floor for 15 1/2 hours, sometimes reading from the Bible or offering recipes for Roquefort salad dressing. Harry's spelling was not much improved from years past, for all he had advanced in station. He had trouble with words like occasion, which he wrote O-C-C-A-T-I-O-N. He couldn't spell Hawaii, and wrote of Senator Burns as Senator B-U-R-N-S. He failed even with the spelling of his own home address, addressing envelopes repeatedly to Mrs. Harry S. Truman at 219 North Delaware, D-E-L-E-W-A-R-E, Street. In the month of July alone, he wrote 34 letters to her. To pass the evenings, he read Volume 1 of Douglas Southall Freeman's biography of Robert E. Lee. Or he would work his way through the New York Times. Always an ardent reader of newspapers, like most politicians, he was now taking the Washington Star, the Washington Post, and the Baltimore Sun, in addition to several Missouri papers. But he saved the New York Times for the quiet of evening. It was the summer Will Rogers was killed in a plane crash in Alaska, news that left Harry feeling devastated. Rogers had been a second Mark Twain, he told Bess. No one has done more to give us common sense. One evening, with a dozen others from the Senate, he crossed the Potomac to attend a party given by the chairman of the new Securities and Exchange Commission, Joseph P. Kennedy, at Kennedy's rented estate Marwood, a 33-room Renaissance chateau in the cool of the woods above the river. In a letter to Bess, Harry described it as a grand big house a half mile from the road in virgin forest with a Brussels carpet lawn of 5 acres all around it, a swimming pool in the yard, and all the other trimmings. He had never been in such a house. He was told it had cost $600,000 to build. He felt complimented to be included in such a party, but of his host he had nothing to relate. He was trying to find an apartment they could afford for the year ahead. Found a rather nice place at 1921 Kalorama Road. It was a northwest corner, fifth-floor apartment, 2 bedrooms, 2 baths, living room, small dining room, large hall, $125 per month, no garage. Then I looked at a house at 2218 Cathedral, a block north of Connecticut. They were painting and papering it from cellar to attic. It had a 2-car garage. They wanted $90 per month. I then went down to the Highlands at California and Connecticut. They had a nice 2-bedroom apartment on the southeast corner, 4th floor, at $125. Better, I think, than 1921 Kalorama Road. Then I looked at the Westmoreland right behind the Highlands on California. They wanted $100 for a two-bedroom apartment on the sixth floor and $79.50 for one on the fourth floor that had four rooms. It is an old place, but the location and rooms were very nice. I am going back to look at 2416th Street and the Jefferson tomorrow and a couple of houses. I bet I find something that'll suit before I quit. Not only was he the senator from Pendergast, he was one of the poorest of senators, a point he felt acutely. He never ceased worrying about money and whether he could make ends meet in Washington on a salary of $10,000. In his letters to Bess, he reported the amount of his bus fare, 20 cents, the charge for 6 months of the Washington Post, $7.50, an old grocery bill, $9.53. Thinking he might go over to the Maryland seashore for the 4th of July weekend, he was extravagant and bought a bathing suit, but then went to a public health dentist to have two teeth filled. He had always wanted to be able to buy house furnishings of his own choosing. He dreamed extravagant dreams, he told her, of paintings by Holbein and Franz Hals, of Bokhara carpets, Hepplewhite dining table and chairs, and mahogany beds, big enough for two. But she must have faith in him. I am hoping to make a reputation as a senator. If I live long enough, that'll make the money success look like cheese. But you'll have to put up with a lot if I do it, because I won't sell influence, and I'm perfectly willing to be cussed if I'm right. On three occasions in midsummer, he traveled to New York to see Tom Pendergast, who was living like a potentate in a 29th-floor suite at the Waldorf Astoria at a daily rate that would have covered Harry's rent for a month. To his surprise and delight, TJ's welcome was the warmest ever. "Pendergast was as pleased to see me as if I'd been young Jim," Harry reported to Bess after the first meeting. "We talked for 3 hours about everything under the sun." On the second visit, 2 weeks later, TJ was as pleased to see me as a 10-year-old kid to see his lost pal. Hints of a huge insurance scandal were in the wind, involving a Pendergast man in the state government, R. Emmett O'Malley, Missouri's superintendent of insurance. Marquis Childs of the Post-Dispatch had been to the Waldorf to interview TJ earlier in the spring, before TJ sailed for France on the new Normandy, and in the course of the questioning, TJ had said, "Yes, I told O'Malley to approve the insurance deal," adding angrily, "and what are you going to do about it?" which had been a mistake. When Childs went to the ship later to see TJ off, he found him in a better mood. Pendergast and the very blonde Mrs. Pendergast were ensconced in the living room of their suite, which was almost literally filled with flowers, orchids, and lilies of the valley, expensive flowers. This was Pendergast, the Maharaja of Missouri in all his glory. But apparently Harry's conversations at the Waldorf included none of the truth of what was going on behind the scenes with O'Malley, even if to Harry it appeared as though he and TJ had covered everything under the sun. One topic they did take up was a replacement for Governor Park, who by Missouri law could serve only a single term. Harry thought perhaps it should be a wealthy Pike County apple grower named Lloyd C. Stark. Harry and Stark had met through the American Legion. Stark, too, had served as an artillery officer in France, and had compared notes as time went on, Stark confiding his own political ambitions. Harry had been a guest at Stark's estate in Pike County in northeastern Missouri, home of the Stark Nursery, largest in the United States, and famous for the Stark delicious apple. At Stark's urging, Harry had provided him with a list of key people throughout the state, and put in a word for him at 1908 Main Street. "Confidentially, I had a fine visit with our mutual friend in Kansas City last Friday," Stark had written Harry that spring of 1935. delighted by how things were shaping up. But T.J. didn't like Stark, and had already crossed him off as a possible governor at the time of Francis Wilson's death. At Wilson's funeral, a news photographer happened to catch the massive big boss and the trim, elegantly tailored apple grower, each with cigarette in hand, deep in conversation among the parked cars. Neither T.J. nor Jim Aylward thought Stark could be trusted and told Harry so.
"He won't do," said T.J. "I don't like the son of a bitch. He's no good."
Long afterward, Harry would remark to a friend, "The old man had better judgment than I did." However, as was said, the apple grower was also an accomplished apple polisher. And when Harry took both Stark and Bennett Clark with him on a third trip to the Waldorf that summer, T.J. at last consented. Stark was to have the organization's full support, which meant Stark could count on being the next governor, and, of course, with the implicit understanding that the organization could in turn count on Stark. On the train back to Washington, Stark, the most grateful man alive, promised to do anything to help Harry any time. He had only to say the word. Relations with Bennett Clark, meanwhile, were also improving. Few in the Senate had been quite so contemptuous of Truman as Clark during Harry's first several months, and Clark still did little to make Harry's job any easier. Clark also seemed to go out of his way to annoy or embarrass the administration, and yet, invariably, it was Clark that Roosevelt worked with on federal appointments in Missouri, not Senator Truman, who voted consistently with the administration. It was Roosevelt's way of trying to win Clark over, and Clark's way of getting more than his share of patronage, all of which left Harry far out in the cold, trying to swallow his pride and resentment. Further, Clark had little time for what Harry called the ordinary customers from back home who had favors to ask or troubles to settle. But Clark, as Harry recognized, was a man with an extraordinary mind, who knew the Constitution and parliamentary law as well as anyone in the Senate. He was hugely entertaining, a good host, a good cook, country ham with red-eye gravy and turnip greens his specialty, and like Cactus Jack Garner, he enjoyed a sociable libation over lunch, or in mid-afternoon, or day's end, or most any time. Harry adored the banter and storytelling that went with this side of senatorial life. It was closer to the comradeship of army life than anything else he had known. He enjoyed Clark's humor as they took a little something to settle the nerves. At a lunch for the health faddist, Bernard McFadden, they regarded each other with long faces across the table. "Kind of hard on Bennett and me to attend a dry lunch in this town," Harry noted. In his office, for special guests like Clark, Harry kept a supply of T.J.'s best bourbon. "And while I heard criticism aplenty of Pendergast himself," recorded William Helm, "I have yet to hear a noble senator raise his voice against the quality of Pendergast liquor." Other supplies for the thirsty were kept by the Secretary of the Senate, Colonel Edwin Halsey, and later by his successor Les Biffle, in an office only a short stroll across the hall from the chamber. Unlike Clark, Harry kept to a rule of one stroll, one drink only. Though younger than Harry by 6 years, Clark was heavy-set and jowly, and with his thinning hair looked both older and more senatorial. Clark's biography in the Congressional Directory, written by Clark himself, took up nearly three-quarters of a page of fine print. Senator Truman's, also self-penned, consisted of three lines. A year later, in the summer of 1936, as the Democrats convened in Philadelphia to renominate Franklin Roosevelt for a second term, Harry was with T.J. again, and more conspicuously now than at any time in years past. just back from still another European vacation. He had returned this time on the maiden voyage of the Queen Mary. T.J. came down to Philadelphia by train from New York, planning to commute back and forth every day from his suite at the Waldorf. He arrived Tuesday, June 23rd, the morning the convention opened. Jim Farley, chairman of the National Committee, Jim Aylward, and Senator Truman clustered about him to pose for pictures on the convention floor, T.J. beaming as the flash cameras exploded. All the big bosses of the Democratic Party were gathered in Philadelphia. Franklin Roosevelt's favorite, the urbane, affable, extremely powerful Edward J. Flynn of the Bronx, tall, natty Frank Haig of Jersey City, who would be remembered by history for his comment, "I am the law." Mayor Edward J. Kelly of Chicago, E.H. Boss Ed Crump of Memphis, former farm boy and noted bird lover, and T.J. Pendergast, a white carnation in his lapel, who the day before had celebrated his 64th birthday. At one time or other, Roosevelt had courted and worked with them all, depending on their help, and he would again. He called them all his friends, and all appreciated perfectly what wonders the Roosevelt magic had worked for them in 4 years. As Marquis Childs observed, the vast expenditures of the New Deal had put into their hands power they had hitherto scarcely dreamed of. Though no one could know it at the time, the day was to mark T.J.'s last big public appearance. So, as a gathering of the era's big-city Democratic bosses, all figuratively on stage together, it was a final historic moment. Harry, who had driven up from Washington, had no real part to play. He had been named to no committees of importance. He was only a delegate at large. He was there really to be with Pendergast, and indeed the group photograph taken on the convention floor is the only known picture of him at the boss's side. Returning by train to New York that night, Pendergast was suddenly taken ill. The doctors diagnosed coronary thrombosis. Harry, who had stayed on in Philadelphia but did not bother to remain for Roosevelt's speech the final night, apparently was not told for some time how serious the situation had become. In August, still confined to his hotel room, T.J. suffered another relapse and was rushed to Roosevelt Hospital for surgery. He had intestinal cancer, and the operation required the closing of his rectum. For T.J., it meant the use of a tube in his side for the rest of his life. Had T.J. only died that summer, Harry Truman would later reflect, his reputation would have been secure as the greatest political boss of the time. But it was not to be. Not until September was Pendergast able to return to Kansas City, traveling by train in a special car and with great secrecy. By then, the primaries were over, the organization having performed at peak efficiency. Lloyd C. Stark was the Democratic nominee for governor, and as certain of election in November as was Franklin D. Roosevelt. Section 4. During the second half of his first term in the Senate, Truman felt the cloud he was under begin to recede. His standing among his colleagues improved. He was assigned more spacious offices down the hall, suite number 240, again looking onto the interior courtyard. By his own staff, by others on his committees, he was perceived as dogged, productive, respectful of the opinion of others, good-natured, and extremely likable. "We all found Truman a very nice man, and his heart was in the right place," recalled the historian Telford Taylor, who was then a young attorney on the Interstate Commerce Commission. The senator's patience, even with the dreariest assignments, seemed infinite. And though no one would have singled him out as exceptional in any particular way or predicted a brilliant future, but he showed no signs of leadership Taylor also remembered, his reputation was clearly on the rise. The Republican Bora, one of the Senate's certified great men, made a point one day of throwing his arm about Senator Truman's shoulder in an open show of friendship. Truman was even attempting an occasional speech in the chamber by this time, reading always from prepared texts heavy with facts and figures. Once, in the middle of a debate, Arthur Vandenberg called on him to substantiate a point, and after Truman obliged, Vandenberg told the Senate, "When the senator from Missouri makes a statement like that, we can take it for the truth." It was a gesture Harry would not forget. He was always going out of his way to do favors for others, and you couldn't help but like his smiling, friendly manner, said Vic Messall. And he was that way with everyone. I never heard him say a crossword to his staff, and that's a real test. Mildred Dryden, Truman's secretary, said, "Never in all the years that I worked for him did I ever see him lose his temper. He was always soft-spoken and very considerate to his staff." She remembered no salty language either. Never, ever, if women were present. Alban Barkley, though he had liked Harry Truman instinctively from the start, said that his real appreciation of the man only came clear to him at the dramatic climax of the battle over Roosevelt's court-packing plan, the contentious, frustrating issue that dominated in 1937. In his acceptance speech at the Philadelphia Convention, the speech Harry had missed hearing but called a masterpiece after reading it in the papers, Roosevelt said, "To some generations much is given. Of other generations much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny." In his second inaugural address in January 1937, the president became more specific. "I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished," he said, and the Congress, like the country, had waited in anticipation to see what new legislation he would demand. In the first week of February came the surprise. It was the Supreme Court he was out to reform, really to reshape to his liking, because the court had found some earlier New Deal programs unconstitutional. His scheme was to enlarge the court from 9 members to 15 if justices refused to retire at the age of 70. And after the landslide in November, which gave him the largest majority in Congress ever enjoyed by a president, Roosevelt felt confident of having his way. He neither consulted with the leadership in Congress nor gave any advance word of what he was up to. The president was wrong in his approach. The whole attempt to influence the decisions of the court by increasing its size was a blunder, damaging to Roosevelt and to the Senate. Opposition in the Senate was fierce, and especially among Democrats, including not just conservatives like Carter Glass and Bennett Clark, but such formerly reliable Roosevelt men as Connally and Wheeler, who now led the fight against the court-packing bill. Barkley, Truman, virtually every Democratic senator who had been a steadfast Roosevelt supporter, now found himself caught between vehement pressure from the White House on the one hand, and on the other, outrage at home over the whole idea. By June, even Garner, Roosevelt's own vice president, had become so infuriated over the affair that he packed his bags and went back to Texas. "The people are with me," Roosevelt had snapped when Garner took issue with him. A disappointed Carter Glass thought probably the Senate was with him too, so great was the Roosevelt magic. "Of course I shall oppose it," said Glass. "I shall oppose it with all the strength that remains to me. But I don't imagine for a minute that it'll do any good. Why, if the president asked Congress to commit suicide tomorrow, they'd do it." Truman, like Barkley, decided to stand with the president. on the grounds that the size of the court had been changed before in times past. But he took no part in the debate. He was preoccupied with the railroad investigations, where Wheeler, because of his part in the court battle, had lost interest and left him most of the work, making Truman vice chairman of the subcommittee. In June, in the midst of the court fight, Harry ventured his longest, most daring speech thus far in the Senate, a preliminary report on the railroad investigations. As summer came on, he would have preferred greatly to stay free of the whole court issue, and like so many, wished only that it had never happened. He found himself deluged with angry mail. Having announced his position on the bill, he was accused of being a Roosevelt stooge. His headaches returned. At the White House, the president's advisers were saying that if this fight were won, everything else he wanted would fall into the basket. But all strategies were suddenly shattered on July 14th, when Majority Leader Joseph Robinson, who had been carrying the fight for Roosevelt, fell dead in his apartment across from the Capitol, the victim of a heart attack. Only days before, Senator Royal Copeland, who was a physician, had slipped into a seat beside Robinson to warn him that he should slow down. Bess, who was suffering acutely from Washington's oppressive heat, voiced worries about her own husband's stamina in a letter to Ethel Noland. "Harry is worn out and is not well, and will simply have to have a good rest, or he will be really ill." The fight on the court was deferred until a new majority leader could be named. In the running were Barclay and the arch-conservative Pat Harrison of Mississippi, chairman of the Finance Committee. It was a critical juncture that could determine the future of the New Deal in the Senate, and Roosevelt, determined to see Barclay win, wrote an open Dear Albin letter in which he referred to Barclay as the acting majority leader. To many in the Senate, this seemed arrogant interference with what was solely Senate business, and so another bitter fight resulted. From a private poll, Jim Farley calculated that Harrison stood to win by a single vote. Pressure from the White House grew intense, and not especially subtle. Senator William H. Dietrich of Illinois, who had pledged himself to Harrison, received a call from Boss Kelly of Chicago promising Dietrich a say in the appointment of two federal judges should he vote as Roosevelt wished, which was quite enough to convince Dietrich to switch sides. On July 19th, a day before the vote, Harry heard from Tom Pendergast, who had been called by the White House and asked to tell Harry Truman how to vote. Only in this instance, no offer of patronage was forthcoming. Harry told T.J. that he had already promised Pat Harrison his support and could not go back on his word. "Jim Aylward phoned me, too," Harry told William Helm an hour later. "I didn't mind turning Jim down, not so much anyhow, but to say no to Tom was one of the hardest things I ever had to do." According to Harry, this was the one and only time T.J. had ever called him about a vote. Normally, T.J. made his views known by telegram. But possibly T.J. did not like pressure from the White House any more than Harry. For, as Harry also related, Pendergast had said it didn't make a hell of a lot of difference to him. Why Harry had ever lined up with Harrison remains a mystery. He liked Barclay, nor had he any reason to oppose him, unless he saw it as a way to show the president he could not be taken for granted any longer. He refused to be budged, and was so furious with the people at the White House, the president included, that he could hardly contain himself. By going to Pendergast rather than coming directly to him, they had left little doubt as to what they really thought of him. In their eyes, he was still truly the senator from Pendergast. It was the worst insult he had suffered since coming to Washington, and he decided to let Roosevelt know how he felt. Told that the president was not available, he talked to Steve Early, the press secretary. He was tired of being pushed around and treated like an office boy, Truman said. He expected the consideration and courtesy that his office entitled him to. Senator Barkley, all the while, was under the impression that Harry Truman had given him his pledge of support. Barkley would later describe how Harry had come to him, saying, "The pressure on me is so great to vote for Harrison that I'm going to ask you to relieve me of my promise." It was this four-square approach of Truman's that so impressed him, Barkley said. "I always admired him for the courage and character he displayed in coming to me as he did. Too often in politics the stiletto is slipped between your shoulder blades while its wielder continues to smile sweetly." On July 21st, the Democratic members of the Senate met in the white marble caucus room of the Senate office building to vote for a majority leader by secret ballot. The winner was Alvin Barkley by one vote. Barkley would later speculate on how he might have felt about Harry Truman had he lost by one vote. Harry immediately pledged Barkley his support, and they were to be friends and allies thereafter. The steam was gone from the court bill. On July 22nd, by a margin of 50 votes, the Senate sent it back to the Judiciary Committee where it died. The president had suffered his first and worst defeat since taking office, which, to Harry's mind, he richly deserved. The whole affair, Harry thought, had been a mistake and very badly managed by Roosevelt. As time passed in the comparatively few months of each year when Bess and Margaret were with him in Washington, the Trumans moved from one small temporary apartment to another, to Sedgwick Gardens on Connecticut Avenue in the spring of 1936, to the Carroll Arms on First Street in early 1937, the Warwick Apartments on Idaho Avenue in 1938. In 1939, they were back again at Tilden Gardens, where they began. Margaret, who had grown taller and even more spindly, was attending Gunston Hall, a private school for girls, which was another financial worry for Harry. Independence, however, remained home for Margaret as for Bess, who felt the constant pressure of her mother's need for her. Madge Wallace, who still believed Bess could have done better in the way of a husband, gave no sign of interest in Harry or his career. The long separations grew no easier. "I just can't stand it without you," he wrote to Bess as the new session got underway in 1937. She was not only Juno, Venus, and Minerva to him, he wrote, but Proserpina too, and urged her to look that up. Proserpina, as Margaret would remember ever after, was a goddess who spent half of each year in Hades with her husband Pluto, separated from her grieving mother. His letters dutifully reported his modest social life. He went to the movies, played some penny-ante poker, listened to the symphony or opera on the radio. One weekend he drove to Gettysburg to hike over the battlefield with John Snyder, a St. Louis banker he had gotten to know at summer army camp over the years. Another day he played hooky from the Appropriations Committee and went to the War College to hear Douglas Southall Freeman lecture on Robert E. Lee, which he thought one of the greatest talks I ever heard. His health was uneven, and he worried about it perhaps more than necessary. In the wake of the court-packing fight, he felt so wretched he went to the Army-Navy Hospital at Hot Springs, Arkansas, for a checkup and complete rest. A month or so later, working harder than ever, nerves ragged, he was beset again by savage headaches. "This so-called committee work is nothing but drudgery and publicity," he wrote, "all so depressing sometimes." Vic Messel thought possibly he was drinking too much. William Helm wrote later that he had never known anyone who could hold his liquor so well as Senator Truman. On one occasion, Helm had seen him take 5 drinks and show no effect. Not once did I ever see him under the slightest influence of liquor. The records from his stay at the Army-Navy Hospital at Hot Springs say only that he had developed severe headaches and a sense of continually being tired, a general malaise. The president and his people continued to exhibit only supreme indifference toward him, which became especially grating whenever the governor of Missouri, Harry's friend Lloyd C. Stark, came to town. It had been Harry who arranged for Stark to meet Roosevelt for the first time in October 1936, when Stark was running for governor. By mail and telegram, Harry had urged the president to invite Stark and his wife to join him on board his train as he campaigned across Missouri. "They are charming people," Harry had assured the president in a telegram from Independence. Now Stark went frequently to the White House and spoke warmly of Roosevelt as the chief. Stark was invited to join poker parties on the president's yacht on cruises down the Potomac, something Senator Truman could only dream of. Senator Truman often had difficulty getting the president's secretary even to return his calls. Once, on a quick visit to Capitol Hill, Stark poked his head in at Harry's office door to say that some of the folks in Missouri were trying to get him to run for the Senate when Harry came up for re-election, but that Harry need not worry. When Stark had gone, Harry told Vic Messall, "That son of a bitch is fixing to run against me." Alone one night in October, listening to the radio, he began to weep. "A couple of kids were singing 'They'll Never Believe Me' from the girl from Utah," he wrote to Bess. "And I sat here and thought of another couple of kids listening to Julius Anderson and Donald Bryan singing that beautiful melody and lovely sentiment, and I wished so badly for the other kid that I had to write her to sort of dry my eyes." No one ever seemed to understand how sentimental he was below the surface. He was lonely, homesick, feeling unappreciated, feeling sorry for himself, thinking often of times gone by. "Today is my father's birthday," he wrote on December 5th. "He'd be 86 if he'd lived. I always wished he'd lived to see me elected to this place. There'd have been no holding him." The brighter side was an unlikely new friendship. A staff member of the Railroad Subcommittee, Max Lowenthal, had invited him to meet Justice Louis D. Brandeis at one of the winter teas that Brandeis and his wife gave Sunday afternoons in an old-fashioned apartment on California Street. These Brandeis teas, as Marquis Childs would write, had become a slightly awesome institution in the Capitol, with Mrs. Brandeis presiding as umpire over a kind of musical chairs game designed to give the justice 10 or 15 minutes of individual conversation with as many guests as possible within an hour and a half. Truman was not accustomed to meeting such people, he had told Lowenthal candidly when the invitation was first issued. But to his surprise, Brandeis had spent more time with him than any of the other guests, wanting to hear about Harry's railway investigations, and appearing extremely pleased to learn that Harry had read some of his books. They sat in stiff, uncomfortable chairs in a large living room where little had changed since the time of Woodrow Wilson, the walls decorated with photographs of classical ruins. Brandeis, the first Jew to serve on the Supreme Court and the country's most distinguished Jeffersonian liberal, was by then in his 80s, and to Harry, a great old man. The day was cold, with snow forecast, but Harry felt warmed by the whole experience, a little out of place, yet more welcome than he had ever expected. "It was a rather exclusive and brainy party. I didn't exactly belong, but they made me think I did." He went several times again, and as he later wrote, he found that he and Brandeis were certainly in agreement on the dangers of bigness. The influence of Brandeis was apparent soon enough. On Monday, December 20, 1937, Senator Truman delivered the second of his assaults on corporate greed and corruption. In the earlier speech in June, he had recalled how Jesse James, in order to rob the Rock Island Railroad, had had to get up early in the morning and risk his life to make off with $3,000. Yet, by means of holding companies, modern-day financiers had stolen $70 million from the same railroad. "Senators can see," he said then, "what pikers Mr. James and his crowd were alongside of some real artists." Now, in a prepared address written and rewritten several times with the help of Max Lowenthal, he attacked the power of Wall Street and the larger evil of money worship, sounding at times not unlike his boyhood hero, William Jennings Bryan. He had announced the speech in advance, so as to be heard by something more than an empty chamber. "It probably will catalog me as a radical," he warned Bess, "but it will be what I think." His lifelong hatred of high hats and privilege, all the traditional Missouri suspicion of concentrated power and of the East, came spouting forth with a degree of feeling his fellow senators had not seen or heard until now. He attacked the court and lawyer situation in the gigantic receiverships and reorganizations that destroyed railroads, and named the powerful law firms involved: Kravath, de Gersdorf, Swain and Wood, of New York; Davis, Polk, Wardwell, Gardner and Reed, also of New York; Winston, Strawn and Shaw, of Chicago. He cited the immense fees taken by the attorneys for the receivers, told how some attorneys took their families on free vacations to California in the private cars of a bankrupt line, how a receivership judge on the federal bench had a private car on the bankrupt Milwaukee and St. Paul at his beck and call. "Do you see how it pays to know all about these things from the inside?" he asked. "How these gentlemen, the highest of the high hats in the legal profession, resort to tricks that would make an ambulance chaser in a coroner's court blush with shame? The same gentlemen, if the past is any guide to the future, will come out of the pending receiverships with more and fatter fees, and wind up by becoming attorneys for the new and reorganized railroad companies at fat yearly retainers. And they will probably earn them, because it will be their business to get by the Interstate Commerce Commission to interpret and to see that the courts interpret laws passed by the Congress as they want them construed. These able and intelligent lawyers, counselors, attorneys, whatever you want to call them, have interviews and hold conferences with the members of the Interstate Commerce Commission, take them to dinner, and discuss pending matters with them. The commission, you know, is the representative of the public, and it has its lawyers also. But the ordinary government, mine-run, bureaucratic lawyer is no more a match for the amiable gentlemen who represent the great railroads, insurance companies, and Wall Street bankers than the ordinary lamb is a match for the butcher." The underlying problem throughout, he said, was avarice. Wild greed. "We worship money instead of honor. A billionaire, in our estimation, is much greater in these days in the eyes of the people than the public servant who works for public interest. It makes no difference if the billionaire rode to wealth on the sweat of little children and the blood of underpaid labor. No one ever considered Carnegie Library steeped in the blood of the Homestead steel workers, but they are. We do not remember that the Rockefeller Foundation is founded on the dead miners of the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company and a dozen other similar performances. We worship mammon. And until we go back to ancient fundamentals and return to the giver of the tables of law and his teachings, these conditions are going to remain with us.
It is a pity that Wall Street, with its ability to control all the wealth of the nation and to hire the best law brains in the country, has not produced some statesmen, some men who could see the dangers of bigness and of the concentration of the control of wealth. Instead of working to meet the situation, they are still employing the best law brains to serve greed and self-interest. People can stand only so much, and one of these days there will be a settlement.
He saw the country's unemployment and unrest as the fault of too much concentration of power and population, too much bigness in everything. The country would be better off if 60% of all the assets of all insurance companies were not concentrated in four companies. 1,000 insurance companies with $4 million each in assets would be 1,000 times better for the country than the Metropolitan Life, with its $4 billion in assets. Just as 1,000 towns of 7,000 people were of more value than one city of 7 million. Wild greed along the lines I have been describing brought on the Depression. When investment bankers, so-called, continually load great transportation companies with debt in order to sell securities to savings banks and insurance companies so they can make a commission, the well finally runs dry. There is no magic solution to the condition of the railroads, but one thing is certain. No formula, however scientific, will work without men of proper character responsible for physical and financial operations of the roads and for the administration of the laws provided by Congress. The speech was front-page news in the New York Times and drew the immediate attention of labor leaders and reform-minded citizens across the country. Nor did anyone in the Senate doubt that he had done his homework. Not even the dullest of hearings seemed to wear him down, and some were as dull as ever recorded at the Capitol. Many times, he was the only senator present. In the eyes of those working with him, he had also shown uncommon courage. Much of the focus had been on the financial finagling behind the bankrupt Missouri Pacific Railroad. Max Lowenthal, a former labor attorney, had written a critical analysis of railroad reorganization, The Investor Pays. As an expert on the subject, he warned the senator that the inquiries might produce some pretty hot stuff, and that this could be embarrassing for him in Missouri. Truman instructed Lowenthal and the staff to proceed as they would with any other investigation. Pressures on him to call off the hearings, or at least to go easy, did become intense. But there was no letting up. Lowenthal did not think there were a half dozen others in the Senate who could have withstood the pressure Truman took. The hearings continued, the senator cross-examining witnesses in a courteous but persistent fashion. Lowenthal would remember that it seemed an innate part of his personality to be fair, and to know what is fair, and to exercise restraint when he possesses great power, particularly the power to investigate, the power to police. He gave witnesses all the time they wanted. Ironically, the senator whose own background had seemed so suspect was gaining a reputation as a skilled investigator. Though it did not seem of particular importance at the time, Truman was also taking positions on civil rights that appeared to belie his Missouri background. He consistently supported legislation that would abolish the poll tax and prevent lynchings. In 1938, in a Senate battle over an anti-lynching bill, he voted to limit debate on the bill in an unsuccessful effort to break a filibuster against it. Still more outspoken were his feelings on preparedness, national defense. "We must not close our eyes to the possibility of another war,"
he warned an American Legion meeting in Larchmont, New York, in 1938, because conditions in Europe have developed to a point likely to cause an explosion any time. He called for the establishment of an air force second to none. No one could be more mistaken than the isolationists, he said. America had erred gravely by refusing to sign the Versailles Treaty and refusing to join the League of Nations. We did not accept our responsibility as a world power. America couldn't pull back and hide from the world. America was blessed with riches, and America wanted peace. But in the coming struggle between democracy and dictatorship, democracy must be prepared to defend its principles and its wealth. The end for Tom Pendergast was drawing near. The once robust, florid big boss looked dreadful, gray, drawn, physically diminished, and for all his high style of living, he was close to financial ruin as a consequence of his chronic, consuming need to gamble. In 1 month, he lost nearly $75,000 betting on the horses. His new private secretary at 1908 Main Street, Bernard Nefko, regularly kept tabs on bets of $5,000 to $20,000 on a single race. Later estimates were that T.J. may have squandered $6 million on the horses. But, as would be shown, he had kept these transactions cleverly hidden from friends and family, as well as the government, by using cash only and devising fictitious names to conceal where the money came from and where it went. In the last part of the 1930s, he had become so in debt to gamblers and bookmakers around the country as to be virtually in their control. They spoke of him not as the big boss, but the big sucker. To anyone who knew the story of the Pendergasts and their dynasty, this seemed an odd turn of fate, since it was luck at the track that had given them their start, with Alderman Jim and his winnings on the horse called Climax. Later, in an effort to explain the downfall of Boss Tom, his admirers, including Senator Harry Truman, would insist that he was not himself, that failing health and the gambling fever drove him to do things he never would have done in his prime. A Kansas City police officer named John Flavin, a veteran of years on the force, would remember that on the day T.J. gave him his job, he had said, "Don't ever take any money that doesn't belong to you, and you'll never have any trouble in life." A new federal district attorney for Kansas City had begun investigations, focusing first on vote fraud in the 36 elections. He was Maurice Milligan, the younger brother of Tuck Milligan, and he, too, was Bennett Clark's man. Clark had arranged his appointment. But after the 36 elections, Milligan's chief ally in the assault on Pendergast was Governor Lloyd C. Stark, whose own rise to office owed so much to T.J. and the whole Kansas City organization. Stark had turned on Pendergast as no one ever had or ever dared try, determined to destroy him once and for all. It was Stark's conviction that his loyalty belonged to the people, not to any machine or its boss. The documentation amassed by Milligan and a swarm of FBI agents revealed that approximately 60,000 ghost votes had been cast in Kansas City in 1936. Many precincts had registration figures exceeding the known population. Hundreds of defendants were brought to court, and as the Star reporter William Reddig noted, what surprised most people from Kansas City, who had heard about election thieves for years, was to find how many of them looked just like ordinary citizens, as indeed most were. The trials, lasting nearly 2 years, led to 279 convictions, and Milligan, a handsome, pipe-smoking country lawyer, became a local hero. But what would prove the crucial investigation began only after Governor Stark,
accompanied by Milligan, went to Washington. Bennett Clark had given Roosevelt the tip that Pendergast had failed to report huge sums of income on his tax returns. Roosevelt notified the Treasury Department, and it was then that Treasury investigators started looking into the story of the insurance bribe first described by Marquis Childs in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in 1935. Before they were finished, Stark and Milligan had five federal agencies at work on special assignment. They found that an official of the Great American Insurance Companies, Charles Street, had met with Pendergast in a Chicago hotel in January 1935, or just as Senator Truman was trying to learn his way about Capitol Hill. The Chicago meeting had been arranged by R. Emmett O'Malley, Missouri's superintendent of insurance. Charles Street, speaking for some eight different insurance companies, told Pendergast he wanted the settlement by O'Malley's office of an old issue over fire insurance rates that had kept nearly $10 million impounded, and that, of course, he was willing to pay for it. When Street offered $200,000, T.J. declined. When Street offered $500,000, T.J. said yes. Later, in the interest of speeding things along, the $500,000 was increased to $750,000. A first installment of $50,000 in cash was delivered to T.J. personally at his Main Street office on May 9, 1935. An agreement releasing the insurance money was then worked out in a room at the Muleback Hotel by Street, O'Malley, and attorneys for the insurance companies, after which further payments on the bribe continued. One delivery to TJ's house on Ward Parkway in the spring of 1936 was for a total of $330,000 in cash in a Gladstone bag. Though none of this was disclosed for some while, Stark fired O'Malley and rumors were rampant. How much or little Senator Truman knew is not recorded. Probably it was very little, in view of how hard he took the news when it broke. But when District Attorney Milligan's term expired early in 1938, and both Stark and Roosevelt were calling on the Senate to confirm his reappointment, Harry Truman found himself facing the nearly certain prospect of being the lone senator with objections. By senatorial custom, he could have blocked the reappointment simply by saying that Milligan was personally obnoxious to him. This he did not do, however, because Franklin Roosevelt called him on the phone and asked him not to, as a personal favor. He could also, of course, have had nothing to do with the matter and remained silent. Instead, on Tuesday, February 15, 1938,